So I'm informed that this class begins at 9:45 or 9:30, whenever. Well, here we are till about 10:30 or something like that. Okay, that's it. So if it's 10:30, I'll stop mid sentence.
No.
No. No. Finish the sentence.
No, it won't be like that.
Yeah. In fact, you can go to 10:35 and this will.
Okay, then I'll stop mid-sentence. Look, what a pleasure to be here. I'm here for a period of 4 months. The family joined me, two members of the family joined me a couple of weeks ago here, almost 3 weeks ago. And I contemplated on what to talk about and thought I would try to combine a number of things into one session. It's really hard when you don't know a context so well, you know, what to aim for. There are many very learned people in this community, and so one can try to speak to that. This is a community of faith, and one wants to try to speak to that. And then I want to be authentic. I want to speak out of myself as well. So somehow I'm trying to bring all of these things together. You're welcome to interrupt me. This is going to sound a bit like a lecture. I don't really mean for it to be. So, also, when I have been here over the last few months, every so often, I think maybe 4 or 5 times for worship, I have noticed that there are a number of songs that are frequently used. Many of them are praise songs. Many of them involve Jesus as the Lamb. So maybe to guide that context in worship, Dr. Booth a few weeks ago had a lovely lesson on Hosanna, and we went right from that lesson into worship, where there were songs that were using Hosanna right and left, and I have to confess that I got stuck on them. And so the lesson fed very beautifully into that, and I hope in some way that my comments will feed into that as well, into a same kind of context. So this is on worship, actually. Parts of it might be a bit heady, but parts of it actually might hopefully have something to say. Where in worship, if we go to the New Testament, do we check? Lots of it is in the Hebrew Bible, Psalms. For me, a good place to go is to the book of Revelation. Chapters 4 and 5. And I think I want to just share a few comments on that this morning, if you don't mind. The book of Revelation, chapters 4 and 5. Now, different ways of looking at it allow me to take the luxury of approaching it in this way. The visions in Revelation 4 and 5 are clearly very different from one another. In chapter 4, John, who is the author of the book, sees the heavenly throne room where God is seated on the throne and is being worshipped. In chapter 5, John witnesses a scene in which a lamb, as if slaughtered, is found worthy to open a scroll and then is worshipped alongside God. Through chapter 4, we as readers and hearers may find the book of Revelation was meant to be heard as well as to be read and studied. I think both. Chapter 1, verse 4 is blessed, you know, is the one who reads aloud this book. So this is meant to be heard. So we find ourselves in chapter 4 in the midst of a very fervent, yet serene and coordinated worship of God, in which there is no mention of Jesus. no mention of Christ. At the opening of chapter 5, however, there is a crisis in heaven, which only the Lamb as slaughtered can resolve. These two scenes are really important for the entire book of Revelation. A lot of people make Revelation out to be a prophecy about the end times. I'm not going to deny that this is an important component of it, but I think the book of Revelation is a lot more than that. And fundamentally, it's about being faithful to God in every sense of the word. We can start there and then start thinking about what I think are less important matters in relation to the book. At the heart of the matter is the following question: what does it mean to worship God? Does the worship of God necessarily involve Jesus? A question, of course, our Jewish sisters and brothers might want to ask. And if Jesus is necessary, then what, if anything, is wrong with the worship of God that is so splendidly displayed before our eyes in chapter 4? In what follows, I'm going to explore with you these two scenes in Revelation 4 and 5. And we're going to ask how these scenes are related to one another. So, first we should set the scene. Before John sees this beautiful vision of heavenly worship in chapter 4, there are three chapters that precede. In the first chapter, John, who is writing from the island of Patmos, and who thinks of himself as a prophet, encounters Jesus, who appears in the form of a magnificent figure, beautiful figure. We can talk about whether that figure is angelic or divine, let's say. But it is Jesus whom he encounters in chapter 1. After this, in chapters 2 and 3, the words of Jesus are addressed to the angel of each of the seven churches of Asia, as it is. And it's great to see this person who's just walked through the door. And in these messages to the seven churches, Jesus is addressing the problems and the opportunities that each of these churches face. Though these messages are highly symbolic and are brought into a common style, they each show special concerns that Jesus has for each of the churches. And in 5 of these messages, the churches are expressly told to repent. The Jesus who speaks here is one who knows in detail the struggles, the failures, and the triumphs of each of these communities of faith. Now, at the beginning of chapter 4, we enter into a different world altogether, it seems. 99 years ago. R.H. Charles, who wrote this famous commentary on the book of Revelation, very learned, made the following statement about chapter 4. He says, "Whereas the messages to the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3 are filled with an atmosphere of restlessness, imperfectness, troubles, apprehension, in chapter 4, John is transported into a sphere of perfect assurance and peace. And then after the wonderful vision of heavenly worship in chapter 4, the feeling of troubledness re-enters the picture as John is plunged into bitter weeping when he learns that all in heaven may not in fact be well. So, I'm putting this rhetorically here. John's vision of a Christless, initially, worship in chapter 4 of Revelation is so different from chapter 5. Indeed, it's different from the visions described in the rest of the book of Revelation. A number of other visions in Revelation show worship going on at work in the heavenly sphere. But let's summarize the content of chapter 4 for just a moment. This could be interesting. So John responds to a voice beckoning him to come up here at the beginning of the chapter. To come up here. And John ascends by the means of the Spirit to the divine throne room through an open door. It's interesting that John's ascent to heaven is not like he has to climb, as happens in a lot of apocalyptic visions of this time. You know, one goes and passes through little hurdles at times, especially in the later Jewish mystical literature called the Hechalot. John sees the open door, there's an invitation, and zoom, he's up there. He's up there into this beautiful throne room. John sees something wondrous. There's a throne with someone seated on it. The enthroned figure, God, is described as being like jasper and carnelian, while a rainbow to be compared with emerald circles the throne. Verse 3. Verse 4, the throne is surrounded by 24 thrones with 24 elders seated on them, all dressed in white robes, are they not, having golden crowns upon their heads. The vision is certainly dazzling, isn't it? Before the throne, there are seven flaming torches, which are identified by John as being the seven spirits of God. And before the throne, there is a glass crystal-like sea. The throne is flanked by four multiple-eyed and six-winged living creatures on each side. They bear the faces like a lion, a bull, a human, and an eagle. John observes what they are doing. This is verse 8. Day and night without ceasing, that is, in the Greek, they have no rest. They do not have rest. Day and night, they do not have rest. As they sing, holy, 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 in the Christian tradition called the Tris Hagia, the three holies. Holy, 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 the Lord God the Almighty, who was and who is and who is coming. The vision draws to a close in a scene of worship. Whenever the living creatures worship God, the 24 elders join in, declaring the supreme worthiness of God, for they say, verse 11, you have created everything, and through your will they came into being and were created. How can anyone, John, or anyone else, possibly find something wrong with this? What a beautiful, beautiful scene of worship. As we know from the beginning of chapter 5 of the book of Revelation, which we're talking about now. From the beginning of the chapter 5, the mood shall turn from the uninterrupted praise of God into what we might call, or I'm calling at the moment, a bit of panic. A bit of panic. As there is no one worthy enough to unleash the contents of a scroll being held in God's right hand. Now, if this Christless vision, this vision that does not mention Jesus in chapter 4, seems so different from the remaining visions of the book of Revelation, it's fair for us to ask what John might have been trying to do here. We could consider whether chapter 4 is to be, as some have supposed, a kind of anti-vision. Anti-vision. That is, it offers a visionary experience in which John ultimately rejects, because God alone, the one seated on the heavenly throne, is unable to resolve a crisis which is confronting the churches. Is John saying that despite this wonderful, unending vision of worship, there is still something fundamentally wrong? To put the matter more bluntly, is John rejecting non-Christian, let me put it this way, non-Christian Jewish trust in the sufficiency of God? Christopher Rowland, a friend who's just retiring as a New Testament professor at Oxford and a wonderful, wonderful person of faith, has suggested this line of thinking about Revelation 4. He concludes, this chapter shows no evidence whatsoever of Christian influence, and it is entirely Jewish in its inspiration. Indeed, John obviously intends a deliberate contrast between the description of worship in chapter 4 and the transformation which takes place as a result of the exaltation, the raising up of the slaughtered lamb in chapter 5. End of quote from him. Now there's another way to interpret Revelation 4. We could understand the vision of heavenly worship of God as a way of setting the stage for what is to happen when the Lamb enters the scene in chapter 5. In this way, John is setting up his readers and hearers for a reversal of expectations. Instead of drawing directly on the worship of God as the basis upon which to announce the coming judgment against evil, John gives more significance to the scene that follows. It's just set up in this way. The worship of God is not as ideal or idyllic as it first seems. It's a subtle, though clearly subtle, foil to a visionary climax that centers on Christ as the Lamb standing as slaughtered, who alone can open the book's seals. What does the scene that now includes Christ do, then, to chapter 4? Well, again, the vision of the heavenly throne room is relegated down to being incidental in this next view, rather than in some way being central to the overall message of the book. We are made to think it was placed in the book in order to provide preliminaries to get out of the way until the real action begins in chapter 5 through Jesus the Lamb. There's a third way of looking at chapter 4. I love setting things up, you know. You're probably thinking with me and thinking, oh yeah, now, does this really go or not? You know, I'm not sure. Let's just sort of wander along here together and see what we discover. So the third way has been suggested by someone else, Larry Hurtado, and by myself in a short commentary I wrote on the book. Revelation 4 draws heavily on Jewish tradition. It's deeply entrenched in the Hebrew Bible and in Jewish tradition. It's essentially, we could say, in inverted commas, Christian, or to use a better term, messianological or Christological.
Yay.
Yes. As a follower of Jesus the Lamb, John the prophet is describing a vision of God that reflects his own convictions. Now, if Revelation 4 is somehow to be regarded as Christological or Christ focused, this is important for at least two reasons. First, it suggests that a non-Christian Jew, put it that way, might not have been able to produce precisely this vision, though I would want to say that a non-Christian Jew as such would have had no problem with Revelation chapter 4, but might not have been able to produce precisely this vision. We'll look at that in a moment. And second, Revelation 4 is then no way incidental to what the rest of the book has to say. And I think we want to underscore that. In fact, perhaps we can have ears to hear the vision as a very cornerstone for what John ultimately wishes to communicate. And here is where I, as a person, not only as a heady, graying academic, but as a person before God, find myself most challenged by this book. Let's explore further how chapter 4 may strike a key theme in the book. Rather than making the claim that the chapter is more Jewish or more Christian that way, I want to emphasize that we're unable to grasp the significance of this beautiful vision of worship in chapter 4 without taking into account some other ancient Jewish visions of worship, and without thinking about other parts of the book of Revelation. The chapter, I want to say, is both essentially Jewish and essentially, let's say, Christian in character. what's Jewish and what's Christian cannot and perhaps ought not to be so easily disentangled or distinguished. So I'd like to draw to attention to three basic areas. First, the relationship of chapter 4 to Christ, after all. Second, the relationship of chapter 4 to Christian communities addressed in the book. And third, the relationship of chapter 4 to John's understanding of worship. And to me, the third one is really the most important here. So first, there is the relation of chapter 4 to Christ.
Can you say those things again?
What? Sure. The relationship of chapter 4 to Christ. Second, the relationship of chapter 4 to Christian communities being addressed. And third, the relation of chapter 4 to John's understanding of worship, to worship, essentially. So first, relationship of chapter 4 to Christ. Christ is nowhere obvious in the vision itself. But we might want to remember how chapter 4 opens. Look back at chapter 4, verse 1. It's interesting, right? The voice which calls John up to heaven is, after all, referred to as, quote, the first voice which I heard speaking with me as a trumpet. Do you see that, those of you who have the Bibles in front of you? Whose voice is this? Well, yes, it is the voice of none other than Jesus himself, whom John has encountered in chapter 1, verse 10. The one who has a voice, a loud voice, like a trumpet. So just as Jesus has done in chapter 1, the voice at the opening of chapter 4, Jesus' voice tells John, I will show you what is to happen after these things. Also, in verse 1 here in chapter 4, John gazes at this open door. This image is very suggestive. Look at the end of chapter 3. Jesus has just said, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens this door, I will come to him and dine with you and he with me. This is chapter 3, verse 20. So at the beginning of chapter 4, John learns that a door in heaven is already, hello, is already opened for him, and he hears and responds to whose voice? To Jesus' voice. Contrary to what the image of a closed door that needs to be opened might lead us to expect from chapter 3, the door John gets to see is already opened. That is, John doesn't have to open it himself to let Jesus in. This open door may imply that participation in this vision of heavenly worship that is brought into play in chapter 4 is not restricted to those who would open the door to Jesus at the sound of Christ's knocking. John's vision is not just to be seen by the Christian faithful, but also describes something meant to appeal to those whose loyalty to Jesus and to God is in doubt. The door is already open. They can come up and see this glorious vision of heavenly worship with John. From chapters 2 and 3, we may realize, if not the biggest problem facing the seven churches, was for John a willingness to compromise faith with culture. This is where I find myself very much challenged. And in classes that I teach in the book of Revelation, I frequently say to students, you know, if you and I were doing what John really wanted us to do, none of us would be here. To get to higher education, to get to university, to get someplace, you know, we have to do well enough economically, don't we, to participate in the system, as it were, enough to have this privilege of studying in a validated institution that is formally recognized within the society in which we live. Anyway, let's leave that behind. All those of those church communities, both the good and the bad, are invited as readers and hearers to follow John into the vision. What can we say? Well, for all the absence of Christ in Revelation 4, it cannot be forgotten that precisely here Jesus is the one who invites John up to the divine throne. Jesus is the one who makes the vision of God possible. And it is Jesus who, is showing John and those who see the vision with him the things that will happen after these things. Fascinating. Jesus is not mentioned, he's not seen, but somehow Jesus is the one responsible for making this vision possible. Now, the significance of Revelation 4 in relation to Christ becomes clear if we pay attention to a number of other details here. For example, I mentioned the seven spirits of God before the throne in verse 5 of chapter 4. In chapter 5, verse 6, the Lamb's eyes are described as the seven spirits of God, again, sent into the whole earth. So there are features that occur in chapter 4 which then are linked with Jesus as the Lamb in chapter 5. Chapter 4 isn't just completely rich apart, from chapter 5. But there is some real underpinning link here. Perhaps also interesting is the image of the lion. The vision of chapter 4 is heavily influenced by this wonderful vision of the chariot, the Merkabah, recorded in Ezekiel chapter 1. In Ezekiel's vision, the living creatures are described in the following order. They look like a human, a lion, a bull, and an eagle. That's Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 10. The vision is simplified in Revelation 4, 7, where each of the living creatures is associated with one being. So in Revelation 4, 7, the order of the list is slightly rearranged. It's not the human who comes first, it is a lion who comes first. And then the bull, the human, and lastly the eagle. Perhaps it's interesting that initially Jesus in chapter 5 is introduced as what? As in chapter 5, verse 5, you can see it in your Bibles. Don't trust me. Don't trust me at all. Verse 5, what is he? He's a lion, that's right. So this lion imagery is here. After John has wept a lot, since no one worthy could be found in heaven to open the scroll, the text reads, "And one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. Behold, the lion out of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals.'" So ironically, though, the portrait of Jesus as a lion king, maybe, cannot be sustained. Leaving the lion imagery behind, John goes on to describe Christ, or Jesus, as a lamb standing as slaughtered. In a moving away from Jesus the lion and promoting Jesus as the slaughtered lamb, John sharply redefines what it means for faithful followers of God to conquer. Christ, through whom God has acted so decisively in history, is not worthy as because he is a power-wielding lion near the top of the food chain to be worshipped alongside God. This is especially so if, after all, the lion imagery has been used to describe one of the four living creatures. The worthiness of Jesus consists in his being the Lamb. There are a number of other things that we could say about this. I'll skip on to the next section, though. Revelation as it relates to Christians. Revelation 4 as it relates to Christians. There are images in chapter 4 that pick up images that are found in the previous messages to the seven churches. So the 24 elders, right? They are never identified with angels as such. They participate in the worship of the four heavenly creatures, as we've seen. They strike up a strong song of praise to celebrate God's triumph. But now the elders in chapter 4 are described as wearing white robes, crowns on their heads, and sitting on thrones. Look at chapter 4, verse 4. And also verse 10. In the previous messages to the seven churches, each of these items, crown, white robes, and throne, are promised to those who are faithful amongst the churches who have been addressed. So it could be that the 24 elders, in the 24 elders, we might think of priestly courses as well that comes out of Chronicles and so forth, the churches are invited proleptically to see themselves. They are their, let's say, counterparts in heaven and represent what they get, what they will be and become. Now, I have to say that as a teenager, I remember asking my sister, whom I'm very close to, she's deaf and has eyes to see and ears to hear things that I don't see nor hear myself, what heaven would be like. And she said, well, heaven would be full of worship. Isn't that wonderful? And I thought, no. I don't want any part of this. If that's what it's about, then, I'll think I'll have to rethink things. But actually, the more one lives with these passages, the more they tug and grab you, or can do so. So that brings us to Revelation 4, reflecting something about John's understanding of worship. The worship of God here is described in two stages. The first is the four living creatures singing, "Holy, holy, holy," to God in verse 8. And the second is when the creatures are joined by the 24 elders, proclaiming the worthiness and glory of God in verses 9 to 11. Now, John here does not take the importance of worship for granted. One thing that we as Christians think about a lot is worship, right? Not only that we worship, but for John, it's how we worship and to what degree of intensity that we worship. For John, thankfulness to God depends entirely on this, not just partly. And there's several things for us to note here. For one thing, John paints the worship of God in chapter 4 as ideal. It is worship the way God really wants it to be on some level. The idea of heaven being a place, of course, for perfect or ideal worship was nothing new during the late 1st century when the book of Revelation was written. But Jewish traditions that took shape during the early centuries of the Common Era increasingly left open the possibilities that the four living creatures, right? Now we take this for granted, but that the four living creatures actually have the capacity to misbehave. For instance, and this is a for instance, in the Apocalypse of Abraham, traditions which can be traced back to the 2nd century CE, possibly earlier. In its present form, it's Christian, but it keeps quite a number of Jewish traditions alive. A passage describes the worship of the Lord for living creatures as follows. And here, just follow with me here for a moment. I, that is Abraham in the Apocalypse of Abraham, right? The seer saw a throne of fire and many-eyed ones round about reciting the song under the throne, four fiery living creatures singing. Each one of them had six wings. With the wings that were on their shoulders, they covered their faces. And with the wings at their loins, they covered their feet. And they would stretch the two middle wings out and fly erect, hovering like a hummingbird. And when they finished singing, they would look at one another and threaten one another.
Yay!
Yes. And it came to pass, when the angel who was with me saw that they were threatening each other, he left me and went running to them. And he turned the face of each living creature from the face which was opposite it, so that they would not see each other's faces threatening each other. And he taught them the song of peace, which is the eternal one has in himself. This is interesting. It's all about focus. Being on God. In Revelation 4, there is no such possibility for such disruption and competition in worship. According to 4 verse 8, back to this, the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes, all around and inside. That is, their eyes are not covered. Day and night, they do not have any rest while they sing. This is the day and night, they do not have any rest while they sing. Just what put me off as a teenager. Whereas an interruption to worship causes problems in heaven, the book of Revelation emphasizes that in the presence of the divine throne of the Almighty, blessed be He, the 24 elders witness an unceasing worship in which they are allowed to participate.
You think it's a polemic against that tradition, or at least
there's something that John is not taking this for granted. And what he's really upset about with the churches is that, you know, they're not worshiping with their lives. You know, they may claim to be worshiping, maybe they are doing it partly, but for John, anything less than that full worship is a compromise. And he sees this playing it out in their lives as they're willing to buy meat, maybe sacrifice to idols, participate in the flourishing, very flourishing economy at that time in Western Asia Minor. You know, quite something. These progressives are just compromising too much. And this principle of ceaseless worship, however it is that one's supposed to work it out, is extremely important for the book. This restless and ceaseless worship may seem like a lot of work. It is not simply, though, a statement about what happens in heaven, but also, in principle, a statement about the character of God's people here. In a play on language, in chapter 14, verse 11, you can see this yourself. Chapter 14, verse 11, however, John will write in an ironic twist here that real restlessness in the sense of being troubled, that is a real not having rest, is actually what happens to those who do not worship God day and night, right? But rather worship the beast in its image. According to the text, those who worship the beast and its image, and everyone who receives the mark of its name, do not have rest day and night. And then the Greek is exactly the same. It's quite interesting. The verb and the not are switched around, but it's exactly the same formulation other than that. For John, authentic worship, seen in the heavenly throne room as a model of faithfulness to God, is 24/7. All the time. Authentic worship cannot be found amongst those whose allegiance to God is fickle and who, even as a matter of convenience, show any measure of allegiance to the beast. Ceaseless worship also functions as a protection from the devil, who, according to chapter 12, verse 10, though already a defeated power, accuses Christians what? Day and night. Again, this thing, day and night before. So to worship God day and night protects from the day and night accusations that the devil brings against God's people. Another point to discern is that the worship between the living creatures and the elders is coordinated. If we're right to think that the elders represent the faithful of the Christian community, then it's precisely their worship that participates in the ideal worship of God in heaven. It's a Christian double who participates in this so-called, now we know, Christless worship in chapter 4 of the book. The 24 elders join the four living creatures' praise of God not only in chapter 4, but also in the rest of the book on four other occasions. And we know from a number of documents in the Second Temple period during this time, this business of coordinating earthly worship with heavenly worship was not a minor matter. What we do as a human community of faith before God is coordinated with the angelic community of which is worshiping God in heaven. This privilege of being coordinated with heaven belongs to the faithful. Together with the living creatures, The elders and we, the living faithful, proclaim the worthiness of God by emphasizing that God was and remains the creator of all things. As the living creatures proclaim in Isaiah chapter 6, 3, the earth is full of God's glory, and this is being proclaimed here. It's not as though faith is to be lived outside of the world, but it's to be lived out and worked out in worship of God in the very world that God is seen to be the creator of. So, we can reflect on how the four living creatures describe God in verse 8. He's the one who was and who is, right? And who is to come. He's God, past, present, and future. A very similar formula. Again, ironically, John loves this irony. Right? Is used to portray the beast in chapter 17, verse 8. The angel explains to John that his vision of the great whore of Babylon as she sits on the beast. The beast, says the angel, which you saw, was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss. This is kind of a parody on the language that is used to describe God here. Whereas the beast represents an unreliable presence in the world, he's here yesterday, gone today, but will be back tomorrow. God's presence in the world is abiding in creation. The living creatures have praised God in the threefold formula known from Isaiah 6:3, holy, holy, holy. This formula played a vital role in the daily Jewish synagogue liturgies. Without reciting it, the worship of God for many Jewish communities was inconceivable. There's a tradition in the early Jewish mystical literature, the Hekalot Rabati, this later text, we won't go into that, but I do want to say this, in which God says, I have no desire for the eternal house of Israel which I created. No desire, except at the time when your eyes are raised to my eyes, and my eyes are raised to yours at the time when you say, holy, 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 before me. This formula was not just a declaration of God's otherness in a way that underlines how distant God is from God's people. Rather, it is an affirmation of God's presence, and even further, it signifies God's intimate presence with the elect. Just a few final points. Is this okay?
Yes.
This is wonderful stuff. Why is Revelation 4 so important? So important in this book? This is a conclusion, but I think the best is yet to come. Why, in fact, is it not an incidental part of the book? Preliminaries to get out of the way before the real action begins. Three reflections here. First, Revelation demonstrates what the book of Revelation, of course, is really all about. The continuous, non-stop worship of God. Those in the churches who have fallen under the sway, and we read this in chapters 2 and 3, of the Nicolaitans, a group John doesn't particularly like, or they've fallen prey to a prophetess called Jezebel, and he doesn't particularly like her either. They may claim to worship God, but in fact have compromised their faith in some way. They do not belong to the faithful Christian community, and by definition, they cannot participate in the authentic, emphasis on authentic, worship of God as described in the vision of heaven. Later in Revelation, chapters 13 and 14, John contrasts those who worship the dragon, the beast, and its image with the redeemed, who are given the privilege of learning a new song, which no one else could learn. It's 14, verse 3. Perhaps the beast, Satan and his entourage, and even the compromising Nicolaitans and Jezebel, those who follow the teachings of Balaam, would make easy theological targets, easy targets for John. You know, it's so obvious that what they are is bad. However, not even John the writer of the book himself is immune to problems. When John sees the great whore of Babylon and all her bejeweled greatness, this is chapter 17, verse 6. What is his reaction? His reaction is that he marvels greatly. It's not as if he is thinking, oh, how horrid. No, the Greek, Thomas. He marvels. He's intrigued by her. That's one way to interpret this. He's intrigued by her. Ooh, John. Moreover, twice, not just once, in chapters 19 and 22, John attempts to worship this guiding angel. So that must be clarified that the angel is just a fellow servant. The angel himself says to John, do not do that. Worship God. And God alone. One thinks of chapter 4. Second, how does the worship of God... So I feel better about reading this book now. John and I aren't that different, you know? Or any of the rest of us. How does the worship of God in Revelation relate to Christ? This gets better. We have seen that the vision not only is mediated by Christ, but also contains details that are later and picked up and associated with him. This leads to the following suggestion. Perhaps chapters 4 and 5 are not two separate or contrasting visions. Instead, we might explore how they are essentially one vision. That is, a drama that unfolds in two stages. The longer John is allowed to look in chapter 4 at the heavenly worship of God, even looking at the spirits of God, you know, looking longer and longer, right? The clearer his perception becomes, aided by one of the elders in chapter 5. John weeps bitterly in chapter 5, not because he has observed an unsuccessful man or angel hunt to find someone worthy enough to open the scroll. Rather, he's being taught, as very often happens, by question and answer. The angel asks, who is worthy to open the scroll? And John doesn't know the answer. Then one of the elders tells him about the lion from the tribe of Judah, as we've seen. John looks at the four living creatures and the 24 elders and now finds himself able to see a lamb standing as if it is slaughtered in verse 6 of chapter 5. So as one who takes time to behold a impressionistic painting, and I'm sure you have looked at some interesting pieces of art. You can do that here in Jerusalem if you go to any one of a number of museums, the Louvre, Florence, someplace. You can look at an impressionistic or cubistic painting, right? The longer you look, the more you see. The more certain things come into focus. John's vision of the divine throne room is coming into focus. The longer he looks, the more he sees. Jesus, who is the Lamb from before the foundation of the world. This is interesting. Chapter 13, verse 8. Some of the English translations, I think, have got it wrong. They associate from before the foundation of the world with those whose names, right, are not written in the book. Or, then, conversely, are written in the book. But Jesus, who is the Lamb from before the foundation of the world, is not a newcomer on the scene. He has been there all along. Thus, a revelation of God by Christ in chapter 4 evolves into a revelation of Christ by himself as the one through whom God has acted to redeem the world. So if chapter 5 still has the beginning of chapter 4 in view, then it is Christ's self-revelation. Who am I? I am this one who is standing in slaughter at the right hand of God. That happens on a more profound level than in the previous three chapters in the book. It's interesting that the book of Revelation mentions Jesus' death in, I think, chapter 11, verse 9, possibly. Jerusalem is the place where the Lord died, and there's two witnesses there that are witnessing to that. But Revelation, just to say that Jesus died in, let's say, the year 30, is not enough. The significance of that death of Jesus is read forward in time to the present, but is also read backwards into the time before even the foundation of the world. This is a reality that pre-exists the creation as we know it. And because it reflects something about the character of God from the very beginning, we don't need to think about what happened to Jesus and the events that were introduced through the death and resurrection of Jesus as God's plan B for the world, but somehow our plan A. Something early Christians had to work with was the whole question of, if something has so recently happened on the scene, doesn't that mean that God is an arbitrary, referee or who changes the rules in the middle of the game? Not so. And Revelation, as well as others who are writing under the guidance of Jewish tradition, are working it out that what we have in Jesus is an expression of God's faithfulness that goes back to the very beginning. Now, for all the importance of Christ in the message to the seven churches of Asia Minor and the rest of the book, the core of John's message cannot begin with the presentation of Christ. The significance of Jesus is not only comprehensible for John if his identity is being, unless his identity is anchored in the activity of one God. King, Lord of the universe, blessed be he. John is functionally centered on Christ. But theologically, he doesn't just stop at Christ. This is quite important. The worship of Jesus can only happen when it is bound up with and serves the worship of the only one God. John remains committed to the conviction that there is only one God. This means that for John, Christ-shaped faith does not stand apart from that of non-Christian Jews. There's a tension here. This isn't quite resolved, and it's actually a beautiful tension. Many of us feel that ourselves. Jews and Christians worship the same God. On the other hand, however, John's way of presenting how this God has revealed God's plan for creation and people at the end time would have been too much for many Jews, contemporary Jews, to bear at the same time. Now, John doesn't want the churches to run away from the problems, but he endorses a program that would expose authentic faith as incompatible with social, political, conformist, or progressive religious positions within culture. John wants the churches to dare to make themselves vulnerable as they follow the Lamb wherever he goes. That's chapter 14, verse 4. A descriptor of those 144,000 redeemed. They should follow the Lamb without having any recourse to some of the privileges which other Jewish communities had been negotiating for themselves in Asia Minor at this climate. John and other followers of Jesus continue to draw directly on the lively and rapidly developing Jewish traditions and practices of their own day. We don't have to go to something. This is the interesting thing about New Testament. Some people think you have to find pre-Christian Jewish tradition before you can make the claim that it affects or influences the New Testament. That's wrong-headed. Jewish tradition is so dynamic and developing during the course of the first century. There is a cross-fertilization that is happening constantly, and it can be seen in the book of Revelation, I think, itself. Even though they're not all on the same page as far as Jesus is concerned, this continuing link of tradition that informs and dynamizes and brings life to faith is very much going on. We don't know how these non-Christian Jewish traditions were making their way into Christian circles, but they were there. We can imagine that the direction taken by John in Revelation would not have left much room for anything but hostile tension with those who say they are Jews but are not, which happens twice in chapters 2 and 3. John is concerned with authentic Jewish faith. But tensions, however acute, cannot mask the interwoven dependence, right, amongst a bewildering variety of Jewish communities who are seeking to find a place for themselves within the Roman Empire, which still, even by affirmation in chapter 4, belongs to the world which God has created. For John, though, the real world is far bigger than Rome or even the world on or under the earth. The cosmos has its beginning and the end in the place where God is continually worshipped. And that's where the Lamb, not always visible now or throughout the course of history, is nevertheless always there. Now this is interesting. That is not so far from Jewish tradition. A book of parables of Enoch, written around this time, speaks about the Son of Man, who is hidden from before the time the stars and the sun were created. Very interesting. He's hidden, but he is being revealed to the chosen now, and to the chosen. So there's a sense that the ability to recognize Jesus within the frame of heavenly worship is a privilege that is accorded to those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. And Jewish traditions run somewhat parallel to this, though they, of course, move in another direction. I think that's all I have to say this morning. I apologize for the time. It's 20 till 11. But thank you, and we look forward to worshiping together in the next couple of hours.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.